Hi, I'm Jay Toms. My sobriety date is 9/11/12, so I just got a year. I have a sponsor and I sponsor others. I definitely have room for more. I will say a lot, probably. I asked Eddie to come and speak for me tonight for a lot of different reasons. The number one reason is because I know for a fact that I would not have made it this far without him. Being in my corner a lot, co-signing my bullshit a lot. And he definitely helped me. He taught me how to have fun until I actually could have fun with everybody else here. This definitely one of the best people and the strongest people in my sobriety at this point. So I'm going to dodge the bullet and hand it over to Eddie.
How's it going, guys? My name's Eddie. I'm an alcoholic addict. Yay. So, yeah. So, I'm in Fort Lauderdale, right? And I'm in a good friend of mine's backyard. And she's got this huge banyan tree, like, in the backyard. Like, the back, it, like, almost takes up the whole back right-hand corner of her backyard. And I come out, and I'm looking at it, and it's looking cool and everything. And I notice there's, like, what looks like an 80-pound honeycomb, like, all, like, writhing with bees, man, like, all up to the right of it and everything. It's, like, taking up almost half the tree. And I'm, like, staring at it, like, really, just, like, mesmerized, man, like, just going blank, staring at it, you know, feeling, like, all serene and whatnot, and then I hear, Eddie! And I'm like, I get mad, you know? I get, like, angry. You know, like, because, you know, like, my moment of serenity just got, like, ruined and whatnot. And, you know, you get mad when you get scared at somebody for doing that for you. I'm like, what? He's like, if you throw that rock at that honeycomb, I'm going to kill you. And I'm like, what are you talking? And sure enough, I had a big old rock in my right hand. Now, this would be all right if I was like, if this happened when I was like 17, but this is I was 35. I'm a year in of sobriety, you know what I mean? So, you know, that quickly taught me like how easily, you know, like a huge like taste for oblivion that I have, you know, and how strong it still is in me, you know? I never surprise myself with that kind of stuff. What about Tay Tom, man? Getting a year. It's like awesome. You know, that's crazy. That's just nuts. You know. So like before he asked me to speak, I was kind of putting myself on like this self-imposed like non-talking jag. I've been doing a lot of like I speaking meetings like lately. I do I also do a juvenile facility meeting on Wednesdays, and I do an Axe detox meeting on Tuesdays. And everyone's got that stuff wrong, man. Like, you know, you're not talking at those places or speaking in these kinds of places to actually help other people. You want to find out how full of shit you are. You keep speaking at meetings over and over and over again. You know, I promise you, that's probably the most that I get out of these things, you know, to a point where I just need to shut up after a while. So, So we'll start off at the beginning. You know, I was born and raised in Key West. I'm first generation born to Cuban immigrant parents. My parents migrated here in the like late 60s. They met in Miami, but and then they had my sister, who's 2 years older than I am, in Miami, and then they moved to Key West, and I was born down there. You know, my mother, God bless her, she was everything that she learned to know about like life in America she learned from like daytime television, you know, like Dr. Phil's equivalent was like Donahue, like back in the day, that kind of thing, you know. And you know, like she believed in this whole sitting down and talking out the problems with the family and, you know, all these kinds of things and the potential dangers. And I could remember her like warning me, like, and my sister about the perils of like getting drunk and getting high. And I heard that term, getting high, and I was immediately curious. I mean, I was like 8 years old, and I was already curious about what that meant, you know. My father was a hard-nosed guy. He was like God to me, and kind of like was God, you know, very elusive, wasn't around much, you know, but you knew that he ran shit, and, you know, you know, and you saw him on Sundays, and that was it, because the rest of the time he was working. But he was a badass, probably like, you know, like the hardest man I've met on two legs ever, my whole life, that kind of thing, you know. He's a commercial fisherman. I worked with him for a few years, a commercial lobster fisherman, and I did that kind of life with him for a little bit. It was pretty brutal, pretty hard. You know, I like my little desk job that I have now compared to that. You know, being on the water at 4 o'clock in the morning, you don't come home till like 7 o'clock at night, that kind of thing, and you work for your living, you know. This is the impression I have of my dad. I watched my old man, like, you know, fishing hand line, you know, where you're pulling, not using poles, and I saw him land 150-pound tarpon by hand line, you know, so, like, that's kind of a lot to live up to, you know? And so he was a beast. He was an animal, you know what I mean? He's like, he's still in better shape at this age that he is now than I am now, you know what I mean? So I had a lot of respect for my dad, quite a bit. And, you know, I remember, you know, growing up and wanting, you know, to live up to my old man. And, you know, my dad, again, God bless him, because, you know, he didn't want me to have that kind of life or anything, work that hard and all that kind of stuff, you know. So he did the only way he did, you know, he's kind of like just almost like pushing me away is what I felt like, you know what I mean? And, you know, I grew up in the house with my mom, basically. And, you know, after a while, he'd let me go out on the fishing trips and stuff with him. And he was still always hesitant, you know. Never hesitant to tell me that I didn't know a damn thing, but, you know, hesitant to, like, just let me kind of experience that kind of stuff. So I guess that's kind of, like, the first times that I started feeling, like, left out and whatnot and, like, you know, why wasn't I allowed to do this? All my cousins were doing it, you know. My dad has 6 other brothers. They all work together. That looked pretty appealing to me, man. Like, if you heard my dad and his brothers arguing on the fish dock, you thought a fight was going to break out any minute now. It was all in Spanish, and, you know, literally it sounded like violence was going to happen any minute now. My dad, I've mentioned this before, is an unconscionable ball buster, you know. He's the best at it. To this day, he's the best ball breaker I've ever met. Some of my friends that know me here, I'm nothing compared to my dad when it comes to ball busting, guys. So, Jay, you got it pretty easy. All right. You know, and like I remember at a young age, like this big, like kind of like a life-changing thing. Like I remember watching my dad get into a fight when I was a kid, and I remember seeing him lose, like losing that fight, and that was a big deal to me. You know, shortly after that, you know, my dad wasn't that big a deal to me either. You know, I guess I started to, you know, lose a little respect for him myself, that kind of thing. And it's kind of a humiliating experience now that I think about it. You know, so if my dad can't beat up your dad, so there isn't a Santa Claus either, and there isn't, you know, and there's probably not much else that you guys talk about. Growing up, I was this size at the age of 8, you know. I got pictures of, like, us playing Duck, Duck, Goose when I was in, like, the 3rd grade or 2nd grade, and I towered over everybody, you know. And I was being told that I'm the same age as them, you know. And but my dad, when he saw me, you know, of course, like, growing up like this, you know, he, you know, I got me a baseball player here. I got me a football player here. I couldn't have been more opposite than those expectations. you know, again, like I was really introverted. I read books, I drew, loved comics, that kind of stuff growing up. You know, in high school, it was being more, it was being shown more and more, you know, evidence of my dad that I wasn't going to grow up to be a baller, you know, or anything like that. And to make things worse, I had an older sister. She's getting into the age of, like, you know, dating now. Well, you know, I grew up in a Cuban strict Catholic family. The older sister doesn't go out without a chaperone. Yeah, that's, you know where I'm going with this. You know, I was already at the age of, like, you know, I was getting heavy into punk rock and all that kind of stuff. My parents are like, we don't give a shit how punk rock you are. You are chaperoning your sister on her dates. And the only good thing that came out of that really was that, you know, I was hanging out with, like, you know, like older, like, jock guys and stuff like that, and their availability for beer and stuff was a lot easier than mine. After a while, I was like, dude, just pick me up, grab the 12-pack, drop me off at the movies, and I'm good. You just have my sister pick me up on the way home. And so a lot of my high school career was spent like that, you know. Right after high school, you know, I guess I should mention the first times that I drank, but I really can't remember them. I always knew that I wanted to feel different in some way. Drinking helped a little bit, and I was always looking for that next thing as far as, like, changing my, you know, my outlook on everything. And, of course, it led me to a lot of other stuff. All of my heroes that I'd been reading my whole life, all of my, you know, the music that I'd been listening to, it seemed to idolize that lifestyle, sex, drugs, rock and roll. You know, as corny and cliche as that sounds, it's what I wanted, you know. That's what I sought out. Right after high school, I took off, left for Philadelphia. I left for just traveling, basically. I ended up in Philly for a while. A lot of drunk stories came out of Philly. A lot of, you know, I discovered the substance that brought me to my knees. I was a, you know, huge opiate addict. And I did that stuff steadily from the age of, like, 24 on to about 3 years ago. You know, that was my thing. That's what I discovered. As far as, like, drunkologues and whatnot, man, I do love a good drunkologue every once in a while, you know. I've got a good one that I'll share. It's the only one that I'll share, and then we'll move on to recovery. I was living in Philly. I was living in Philly. Me and my girlfriend at the time had moved up to Philly from Pittsburgh, and we did that because I'd pretty much ripped off everybody that I possibly could in Pittsburgh, and I had a warrant for my arrest in Pittsburgh, and and I had some friends in Philly, so we moved to Philadelphia. In Philly, I continued to do the same stuff that I was doing in Pittsburgh, and my girlfriend at the time was doing it too. She wasn't as deep as I was, I don't think. And we got into a fight after a while. She decided to move back home to Pittsburgh to live with her brothers and her dad, who hated me. All three of them hated me because they knew what I was doing. They knew what she was doing hanging out with me. After a month or so, her and I start talking again. She convinces me to come back down and pick her up, and you know, because we're in love and all that kind of stuff. And I save up enough money for a couple Greyhound bus tickets. I take a bus down to Pittsburgh. Get to her house, and she flips the script on me, tells me that she doesn't want anything to do with me, you know, that I'm a piece of garbage and, you know, get out of my life and all that kind of stuff. Well, now I'm stuck in Pittsburgh, you know, we're in a town that I can't get the stuff that I need, and I also have a warrant out for my arrest, and all I want to do is just cut loose, man. So to calm myself down, I decide I go to a bar, and I start drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking until I decide that the only logical thing that comes to mind is to go back to this girl's house, and I put a brick through her window, and I start yelling. I don't even run away from the scene of the crime. I just start yelling obscenities in the middle of the street. Her two brothers come out, and I get into a knockdown brawl with the both of them. I'm getting the hell beat out of me. I get up, scramble away, take off running, and they're chasing me. Both of her brothers and her dad. And the last thing I remember before I came to was thinking, I drank up all the money for my bus tickets out of town. when I come to, I'm like in a crawl space, like small, fetal position on my side. It's completely dark. It's sweaty. I have no idea where the hell I am. And my hangover is like kicking in like hard, man. And I'm starting to panic. I'm freaking out, kicking, screaming. The first thought that comes to mind is that these guys got me in the trunk of their car and they're going to take me out to the woods and bury me, basically, like just get rid of me. You'd had to have seen her brothers to understand that fear. They look like guys that would do that kind of thing. So I'm panicking, I'm freaking out, man, just kicking and screaming, and I could start, like, pushing on this thing, like, a little light kind of makes its way through, and I can make out, like, a little bit of grass and stuff. I'm like, I'm in the woods, these guys are going to kill me, I am dead. Someone comes and opens it up. When I spill out of this thing, it was the luggage compartment of a Greyhound bus. As much as I could gather, is I thought I could still weigh on a Greyhound bus and get out of town. The awful thing is that they had the buses parked in a field where they pressure wash them. I wasn't even out of town. The guy was like, freaked out, goes to get help, and I take off running. I hung out outside of a Circle K for like 3 days waiting for friends of mine from Philly to come pick me up. Now I tell that story. I tell that story to you guys, and it's awesome. You guys laugh and everything, you know, it's cool. I tell that story to anybody not in these rooms, you know, as like my best drunk story, and they don't get it. You know, you could hear like crickets like going and everything like that. But then I would tell that story also to my sponsor, and then I would argue ferociously, you know, with all the conviction of the world about being a social drinker, you know, and my right to be a social drinker, damn it, you know. And, you know, he'd calmly just say, dude, you know, you don't have to, no one's telling you you're not allowed to be a social drinker. No one's taking away your right. You know, just know that social drinkers don't wind up in the luggage compartment of a Greyhound bus. It doesn't happen. And I had no argument for that, you know. I had no argument for the idea of this being like a disease or an allergy or anything like that. You know, I did have an argument, a really bad one, you know. The idea of it being an allergy or something like that. I mean, here I was, I'd never taken responsibility for anything in my entire life. And then now, I want to discredit the idea of this me suffering from an allergy because I thought it alleviated the responsibility. And really, you know, I wanted to take responsibility for my life now. But I was going to start fighting against everything that you people were telling me, everything that the big book was telling me, you know. You know, I knew that I was an alcoholic. I knew it from the jump. I knew that I was an addict. I knew that from the jump, you know. But knowing that never changed anything in my life. In fact, all it did was enable me to keep doing what I was doing. Well, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I'm supposed to be doing this, you know. I'm supposed to be getting locked up. And then, you know, again, my sponsor would calmly say, well, don't you think that's a symptom of, like, a sick brain, someone who's suffering from something? You know, to just resign to live like that. I didn't have an argument for that either. You know? It's been a pretty awesome journey, man, this time around. Like I said, I love everything that recovery's given me. It gives me great friends, you know, friends that, like want to hang out and stuff like that, which is weird, you know, for me. You know, I remember, like, working my ninth step for the first time with my parents and with my mom. You know, and my ninth step with my mom, man, took like 3 hours. You know, she remembered everything, remembered more than I did. You know, and coming around this time wasn't my first time around, obviously. You know, my mom knew about the program. Obviously, she knew about it because she wanted me to get better, you know. And this time around, when I'd been sober for a little bit, about, you know, 5-6 months again, I've done that before, you know, she started asking about, are you working your steps? And I'm like, yeah. She's like, you got into the ninth step yet? And I said no. And she's like, well, when you get there, you let me know and we'll talk, you know. There is no way around it. You know, by the end of working my ninth step with my mom, man, I was ready for people to tell me to go fuck myself, you know, because I didn't like remembering all of this stuff. I thought the worst thing that I'd done to my parents growing up or when I was in my addiction or my alcoholism was stealing their car, was like, you know, stealing money from them, doing dope in their house. You know, no parent looks at, like, their only son and decides that they don't want anything to do with them. My mom, that woman used to drive 3 hours each way to prison for a year to come visit me. And for that woman to be able to look me in the face and say that you're not allowed in this house, that must have destroyed her. You know, this idea of, like, us hurting ourselves and all that kind of stuff, man, it's, you know, I wasn't the one that had to call the ambulance every time that I OD'd. I wasn't the one that had to pack up my business. I wasn't the one that had to pack up my apartment every time that I went to jail because they didn't know how long I was going to be in there. All that fell on somebody else. And the only idea that I could leave you with as far as, like, you know, my recovery has been paid for, man. You know, it's been paid for. You know, I got the receipts of it all up and down my arms. I got the receipts of it. I got the receipts of hospital bills. I've got the paperwork from jail proving it, man, you know. I've never wanted to own anything in my entire life, you know, not even the stuff that I stole, you know. recovery was the first thing that I really wanted to own for a long time, you know. And doing this kind of stuff is the only way that I could do that, keep doing it. So thank you for letting me share. I'm not sure if that was a half hour or not, but I'm done anyway, so.